Thank you for having the courage to share the gospel with me. You've had one of the greatest impacts on my life and have forever altered its course for the better. I love you, my friend, and always will. Jody Arias, Yreka, California. Responding to Arias's decision to remove the post, Flores suggested that he understood that she likely felt her tribute should probably have been less personal. Yeah, some of it was details that were a little more personal. Not too personal, nothing inappropriate. I just felt funny. I think because I'm a photographer, I tend to communicate more through pictures. So I posted a ton of pictures that I had of him, and I have a ton more that I just can't access right now, and videos and things that I know his family would want. Arias answered. I've been on Facebook and MySpace looking at his profile, looking at his pictures, reading things, about his obituaries, and, any news updates, and, you know, there's legacy.com, right? You can write something about him. I've seen a lot of those postings, Flores admitted. Arias indicated that since Travis's death, she had also been spending a good deal of time speaking to Ryan Burns, whom she described as her potential possible maybe person that you might start dating. She explained that she and Ryan tried not to speak about what happened to Travis, because it's kind of like, oh, and plus, Travis is my ex-boyfriend at the same time he's my friend, so while I'm mourning my friend, how do you talk to your new potential possible maybe person that you might start dating about your friend, even if he was your ex-boyfriend? So it's kind of a gray area. I try not to talk about him too much, but he comes up a lot. Arias told Flores that it was through Burns that she first learned that she was emerging as a suspect in Travis's killing. He said, you know, if you come out to Utah, things are really weird, because everyone thinks that you could have had a hand. Flores took the opportunity to interject, and I've talked to a lot of people, and everybody's pointing the finger at you. You know, everyone is saying, I don't understand what happened to Travis. I don't know who killed him, but you need to look at Jody. And sometimes the simplest answers are the correct ones, and that's one of the reasons I've started looking at you a little bit closer. So one of the reasons I am here is to talk to you to figure out what was going on between you two. I know the relationship that you guys had was of convenience sometimes. Obviously, you weren't boyfriend-girlfriend anymore. But you were still having a sexual relationship, which you know... Flores's declaration appeared to stir something in Arias.
Does his family know about that?
She asked, the first time in the interview she expressed concern over something. She claimed it was because she wanted to protect Travis and how he was remembered. Even after Flores assured her that Travis's family didn't know anything, Arias continued to steer the interview in this direction. She seemed overly concerned with the afternoon sexual encounter and appeared to be prying into the images that were actually recovered. Her preoccupation led me to think that perhaps there were more than 6 photographs taken that afternoon during their sexual romp.
The reason I care about that is because he was adamant about that, and a couple times we prayed about it. It didn't work, or we didn't stick to our, you know, guns on it, and, one time a girlfriend of mine just said, why don't you just go to the bishop and talk and ask Travis the same? And I talked to him about it, and he got really angry. He said, I've already had problems with this in the past. I'm embarrassed by it. I don't want to go to the bishop. And so we just kind of stopped for like a few weeks, and then that must have been in, I think it was August, and then it just resumed.
As I watched the video over the course of several hours, I came across numerous things that would be helpful in my preparation of the case, ranging from small, incongruous details in her story to Arias's ability to maintain composure. More than anything, though, I was able to discern how she attempted to manipulate the situation to her advantage and buy herself time to respond to Flores's questions. Detective Flores wanted Arias to know that as part of the police investigation, he'd read Travis's journals. And he told her that they indicated that Travis felt his relationship with Arias was unhealthy. Maybe you didn't understand why he didn't believe it was healthy?
No, I didn't think it was healthy either. spiritually at least, and probably emotionally, but mostly spiritually. And once you have something that's not healthy spiritually, it filters through all aspects of your life." Arius continued, saying that while that was one of the reasons she moved back to Wairika, it was not the primary reason. Instead, she cited financial hardship, followed by desire to be closer to her family, particularly her younger siblings, as her number one and two reasons. But also, as she put it, "too much of my nightlife was about Travis." She went on to describe Travis's supposed late-night requests to see her, saying that he would text me and, "hey, I'm getting sleepy, dot, 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 and a bunch of Z's," and that was code to, like, "come on over" kind of thing. As I listened to her describe the relationship, it was easy to see the routine that their relationship had apparently taken. As Arius described it, "I lived 5 minutes away to maybe 10, depending, and it was just too convenient and too easy, and it was fun, and we had fun when we were together, and so it wasn't healthy, and I totally agree with that." At different points during the interview, Arius talked about how she and Travis struggled with the sexual dynamic of their relationship. When she was trying to find work, Travis offered her a job cleaning his house to help her pay her bills, and she grew animated as she described a photo of a French maid's outfit that he purportedly emailed to her, instructing her to wear this kind of ensemble on her first day of work. For a tumultuous period of time, the two of them had carried on a secret sexual relationship, characterized by fits of jealousy and deceit. According to her, Travis's friends warned Arius that he was actively dating and looking elsewhere for a mate, and she recalled how one in particular had even confronted Travis about his behavior, asking, "why do you kiss Jody in the dark and then act like you guys aren't even together in the daytime?" Throughout the two-day interviews, it seemed clear to me that Arius was playing the part of the victim, whether it was crying about her father's failing health, expressing her love for her family, or complaining of Travis's infidelity. But that was not a role that was written for her, at least not under these circumstances. It appeared she thought her sob story would go a long way in making things easier for her, but given the accusations being leveled, it showed remarkable self-centeredness. She seemed to exude a confidence that she could control the interview, and by extension, Detective Flores, if she came across as sympathetic. Flores remained undeterred, digging into each facet of Arius's relationship with Travis as he tried to have his questions answered. I found it interesting that she was evasive with Detective Flores as to why she moved to Mesa after the breakup. Rather than address her stalking behavior, she chose to ramble about different living arrangements she had worked out that would allow her to be in Mesa, but within a safe and appropriate distance of Travis and his church ward. She even claimed that it had been Travis who had talked her into moving back to Arizona, suggesting that when she entertained the idea of moving to Southern California, he had offered up a litany of reasons why Mesa would be the more desirable location. "And he's really persuasive," she said, smiling. "He persuaded you to stay there in Mesa?" Flores asked, a tone of disbelief in his voice. He kind of was playing up all the advantages if I did come to Mesa. You know, it's a great place. We could still see each other and hang out on occasion. This church is very strong. You know, you'll probably make a lot of friends. And I already knew all this stuff prior because we'd talked about that. So I went ahead and just made the move. It sounded at the time like a good idea." No more than 5 minutes later, Arius contradicted herself when she told Flores that when one of her roommate situations in Mesa didn't work out, and she moved again to a place that was closer to Travis's, he freaked out about it. This was the kind of discrepancy that revealed how she could meld a story to her benefit. Other inconsistencies in Arius's story were revealed when Flores began to question the route that she claimed to have taken to Utah on June 3rd. He began his questions by talking about the car she rented for the trip. At first, Arias tried to stymie the investigation altogether by failing to name the rental car company that she used to reserve a car for the drive, as if withholding it would make it impossible for the police to track her movements. Despite not remembering the rental car company itself, she did recall every other detail about the car she rented, including that she had rented it at the Reading Airport, that it was a white Ford Focus, and that it didn't have cruise control. "Instead of going to Utah, you went straight out to the Los Angeles area?" Flores asked. Arias's voice was soft and steady as she recounted her movements for the detective. "I went to Santa Cruz first. I stayed the night in Monterey, and the next day I drove to Pasadena." She explained that she had arranged to meet the sister of an ex-boyfriend to do a photo shoot of her new baby. She said when she first arrived in town, she left a voice message on the woman's answering machine, but she didn't get a call back until she'd already left the Los Angeles area. "And which route did you take from there?" Flores asked. He already knew the route she claimed to have taken from their previous conversations, but now he was prepared to dispute her story. The detective listened intently as Arias recited her itinerary.
"I was supposed to get on the 15 and go all the way up, and I somehow got off the 15, she explained.
"And where did you end up?"
For a while I was lost, and I'm not above sleeping in the car, so I slept for a while. I'm a heavy sleeper and I sleep a lot, so..."
"But you were on the 15 for a while, and you ended up getting off the 15 somewhere?"
"Yeah. I looked at a map, and I'm pretty sure I know where I went. Can I draw you a map?"
Detective Flores offered Arias the yellow legal pad he had been using to take notes, and she sketched the circuitous route that took her to Las Vegas and then south into Arizona. She said she first took Interstate 15 north toward Las Vegas on the way to Utah. She then began talking about another freeway, Interstate 40, which runs east and west through northern Arizona.
"Did you actually cross over into Arizona? Is that how far you went?"
"I crossed over twice, I think," Arias said with a giggle.
She next provided an elaborate account of traveling on various freeways, starting with Interstate 15, which runs north from the Pasadena area to Salt Lake City. She claimed that once she arrived in Las Vegas, she mistakenly began driving south on Highway 93 past the Hoover Dam and into Arizona. She said she became disoriented and further lost her way when she ended up on Interstate 40, driving east towards Flagstaff. She said she finally turned around on that interstate and made her way back to Highway 93, heading north back toward Las Vegas, where she finally was able to be reunited with Interstate 15, allowing her to head north towards Salt Lake City.
"I have a problem with this trip," Flores declared. "I've gone over this trip over and over in my mind and on paper, and even if there's still 20-some-odd hours, even if you pulled over to sleep a couple of times."
The detective's inquiry appeared to be a warning that Arias's alibi was not airtight, but she remained impassive and revealed no sign of anxiety.
"Did I tell you I got stranded?" she asked, hearkening back to her earlier claim.
"Yeah, you mentioned that. But if you slept for 10 hours here and here, it would still leave 18-some-odd hours for something else, okay?"
Flores then shifted his line of questioning to a discussion of Arias's cell phone.
"I pulled your cell phone records," he said, referring to a cell phone tower report that police had obtained. "Your cell phone was turned off between here and here," he told her, indicating a stretch of land east of Pasadena, California, to a location south of the Nevada border. "The next place it was turned on was here," he said, pointing to a site on Highway 93. "What does that show me?"
A cell phone cannot be traced if it is powered off. While this piece of evidence alone did not prove anything about where Arias had driven, it would become important to the case because it helped show premeditation. Turning off the cell phone was a deliberate way for Arias to avoid being tracked. It seemed too much of a coincidence that her phone lost power as she approached the western part of the Arizona border, only to have it powered on as she reached Nevada. Still, Arias didn't budge.
Oh, well, I began... Oh, no, no, no.
Is there plenty of time for you to do that? Yes. And do I believe that you had come to visit Travis? Yes, I truly believe it. Did you have the opportunity? Yes, you were traveling alone. There are no other witnesses. Your phone just happened to turn off from here to here?
Well, I didn't turn it off physically, but it died.
And then it magically, you found your charger here.
I got it. It was under the back under the seat on the passenger side, and it was when I was...
When you were lost, you couldn't have maybe pulled over and found it, or...
Well, I did finally start looking when I was stranded. I wouldn't have pulled over when I was lost, she answered, parsing out that she would only stop if she were stranded.
I've been focusing on this and going over and over in my mind why this happened, why your phone turns off here, outside of Los Angeles, the detective posed, indicating a location on Arias's makeshift map.
What city is that? 'Cause I got this far, she responded, pointing to a similar area on the map.
It's not cities, there's towers, Flores explained, referring to the cell towers that had pinged with Arias's locations. Flores was trying to show her that based on the data from the cell phone tower, she had eventually turned her phone on as she approached the Nevada border, but while she was still in Arizona. There's towers dotted all over this place. One tower hit here, he said, highlighting various spots on the map. The other tower here on the 93. There is no way somebody can get on that 15 and magically get on that 93, because the 15 goes right through Las Vegas, right there, and continues this way. It never goes through Arizona again. This tower here, it's not just over the border in Arizona, it's quite a distance inside of Arizona that it hit, because there is a mountain range all along here, and if you are on this side of the mountain range, a pretty good distance, that signal is not going to come, not going to hit Utah or Nevada or California. It's only going to hit in Arizona. After going back and forth on her impossible route, Arias again went to the map. But when Detective Flores confronted her about the freeways and the impossibility of her trip, she started to lose composure and for the first time admitted that she took Interstate 10. In her haste to cover up, she mistakenly said she traveled west on Interstate 10, which, if true, would have taken her to the beach in Santa Monica.
I honestly got lost. It's bad timing, Arias said, hiding her face in her hands.
Were you at Travis's house on Wednesday?
Absolutely not. I was nowhere near Mesa. I was nowhere near Phoenix.
Detective Flores let out an audible sigh in apparent frustration. Her unwillingness to surrender even in the face of compelling proof showed just how much it would take to get her to concede a point. I would need tangible evidence contradicting her story. But I was about to see that even that would not shake Arias. What if I could show you proof you were there? Would that change your mind?
I wasn't there. I was not at Travis's house. Was not.
You were at Travis's house. You guys had a sexual encounter, which there are pictures, and I know there's pictures because I have them, and I will show them to you, okay? So what I'm asking you is for you to be honest with me. I know you were there.
Are you sure those pictures aren't from another time?
Positive. Absolutely positive. Arias's body language did not change. She sat hunched over the table, her arms folded in front of her, and in a soft voice recited her mantra.
The last time I had any kind of sexual contact with Travis was in April.
Detective Flores reminded her of the camera police had found in the washing machine during the initial investigation at the crime scene, the one she had offered to help police retrieve items from the memory card. Remember I told you about the camera?
Mm-hmm.
Remember I told you that card was destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell the truth, because I wanted to make sure those photos were accurate.
And we can pull deleted photos. We can pull every photo that was ever on there, pull the pixels together, get the timestamps on them. Not all of them, but most of them have timestamps on them, and we can verify those timestamps. And I have pictures of you in Travis's bedroom with Travis, pictures of him, and it's obvious you guys are having sex, taking photos of each other, and they're dated and timestamped on the day he died.
Are you sure it's me? Arius asked incredulously. I mean that, 'cause I was not there.
Flores forged ahead, advising Arius that the camera had actually taken pictures by accident during the time that Travis was killed. For the first time, there was a reaction.
Really?
She asked, the muscles in her forehead tightening, perhaps indicating that the detective had struck a nerve. Watching Arius skillfully manipulate the realities being presented to her, I couldn't help but think ahead to a possible trial. If she were to take the stand, she would be difficult for me to deal with, because her stories streamed forth so effortlessly. If I was going to show she was untruthful, I would have to come up with something factual like a receipt, something that she was not aware of or that she had forgotten about. Otherwise, there was a real chance a jury might be taken in by the seamless delivery of her answers. I turned my attention back to the video just in time to hear Flores make mention of a gun. A record check shows that you guys reported a gun stolen, a .25 auto, that just happens to be the same caliber as the weapon used to kill him, he told Arius.
A .25 auto was used to kill Travis?
She whispered, acting as if she were surprised at the revelation. Yeah, along with multiple stab wounds, Flores responded. But the information about the caliber of the gun used wasn't enough to change her story either, and as Flores prepared to bring in the photos that proved their sexual encounter, she seemed to double down on her innocence.
If I killed Travis, I would beg for the death penalty, she said.
Detective Flores continued to push in what seemed a calculated effort to draw out a confession. But as hard as he pressed, he still couldn't stop the conversation from going in circles, with him laying out the evidence and Arius deflecting the blame.
I was not at Travis's house on Wednesday the 4th, she repeated.
You were, 'cause that is when the bloody palm print was left on his wall, Flores advised her. I've got pictures of you that I've blown up, and you've got that little mole right there, he said, pointing to a small mark on her left lower cheek. It's you. It's obvious.
I wasn't there, Arius maintained.
There's pictures of you laying on the bed in pigtails.
Pigtails?
She asked incredulously, cocking her head to the side as if in disbelief. I can show you some of these pictures. Do you want to see the pictures? Will that change your mind? Flores suggested they take a short break so he could retrieve them. Arius called out to him as he rose to leave the room.
Detective, she wailed with a hurt look, I am not a murderer.
Chapter 6. When Detective Flores returned to the interview room, he was carrying the same blue three-ring binder he had brought to my office at the start of the investigation.
What kind of gun is that?
Arius asked him, referring to the weapon in his holster. It appeared she wanted to show some interest in him, and maybe even flirt with him a little. It's a Glock.
I just got a gun.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
They've probably found it by now, Flores told her, referring to the police officers executing the search warrants on the homes of her grandparents and parents, as well as the rental vehicle in which she had packed three boxes and a suitcase. The 9mm gun would later be found stashed in the trunk of the rental car. Arius remained impassive as the detective sat down in the chair across from her, held the binder in his lap so as to shield the pictures from her view, and began to leaf through its pages. These are just a few photos, and I want to be careful not showing you certain photos, because some of them...
Please don't show me,
Arius pleaded with seeming anguish. After reviewing several of the pages, Flores placed the book on the table, opened to a photograph of the exterior of Travis' house that had been taken by police at the crime scene. Remember that?
Arias hid her face in her hands and began to sob.
If Travis were here today, he would tell you that it wasn't me.
No, my job is to speak for Travis right now, and everything Travis is telling me is that Jody did this to me. Flores explained in a stern but mild voice.
Returning the binder to his lap, he again glanced through its pages, momentarily stopping to consider several photographs before deciding on one. Sliding the book toward Arias, he showed her a close-up shot of Travis's face, his hair wet and water cascading down his face.
Remember him?
Is he naked in the shower?
Yes, he is, Flores replied, soon after you and he had sex on his bed.
Looking directly at the detective, Arias tried to neutralize the evidence now before her.
Travis would never go for that,
she stated matter-of-factly.
The last time we had sex in his bed was in April.
Flores was undeterred. This didn't come out very good because they're copies of actual photos, he explained, purposefully placing his legal pad over the lower portion of the next image, a shot of Arias naked and lying back on Travis's bed in a sexual pose.
That's you, and I wanted to cover you up because that's all of you.
Oh,
Arias uttered with an air of surprise.
That looks like me,
she confirmed, perhaps her way of avoiding having to admit the obvious.
You can look at the rest of it if you want, Flores suggested, prompting her to lift up a corner of the legal pad so she could view the full image.
There's a few of those, the detective told her, and there's a few more which I'm trying not to show you because I don't want to put you out there like that to people. Let's just say I've seen all of you, and I've seen all of Travis. But the one that sticks out in my mind is of Travis on the autopsy table, and I'm not going to show you that one.
Or should I?
But this one, he said, flipping the page to one of the snapshots that had been taken by accident. It's your foot, Jody.
He used his pen to highlight parts he wanted to call to Arias's attention.
Those are your pants. That's Travis.
This is his bathroom,
she agreed, appearing to study the image before again starting to cry.
That is not my foot.
Flores did not give an inch.
Those are your pants, he told her.
I have those pants at home if these are the same ones. I don't have a zipper there, though, not on mine.
Next came another round of photographs. You see the date? 6/4/08 at 5:22 p.m. That's when it started. Right there, see that?
Arias picked over the little details in the photos that Flores highlighted.
Do you see the spots here? He asked her now, showing her the photograph of the latent print on the west wall. They look a different color because we used a chemical to enhance this. That right there is blood. It's a mixture of yours and his, and that's your palm print of your left palm.
I don't have any cuts on my left palm, Arias offered.
Nobody said that your cut was on the palm. Do you have any recent cuts that are healing?
Well, my cat scratches me. Little things. These are all her work, you can see,
she said, pointing out little marks on her left arm before again challenging the evidence.
How can that be my palm print?
Because you were there, Flores replied, moving his chair to sit closer to Arias. There is no doubt in my mind that you were there. There is no doubt in my mind that you did this. None. So you can go until you're blue in the face and tell me you weren't there and you had nothing to do with this, but I won't believe you. I will not believe you because Travis is telling me that you did this to him. The interview seemed to drag on, while Flores finally got her to agree that the photographic evidence was very compelling, she diffused its value, suggesting the images could have been modified or altered, and the date and timestamps could have been tampered with.
I didn't modify anything, Flores countered.
I don't think you would,
Arias responded, perhaps sensing she might alienate the detective if she continued in this vein. After watching her repeated denials, I was momentarily caught off guard when suddenly Arias appeared to change course, from accusing the police of manipulating the timestamps on the photos
to questioning that it was Travis's camera that may have taken those photographs.
Can I ask you, I don't know if you know this, oh, I have a camera and it's in my storage unit that I don't use anymore, but that Travis used frequently, Arius began, and we took pictures with it. This is, I don't know.
Do you remember taking these pictures? Flores asked, directing Arius's attention back to the collection of photographs in the blue binder on the table between them.
There were many pictures. We took tons and tons of pictures. Some I saved, most we deleted, she claimed.
It was clear Detective Flores didn't know where she was going with the story, but he continued to lead her along in the direction of what he thought would be an admission.
We took a bunch the week before I left. We took a bunch over the last 6 or 7 months. Last year, even, when we were still dating, but we would delete them mostly. There were some he sent me that I didn't delete. What I'm asking is it possible that, you know, that my memory card would have been in his camera? They're interchangeable.
And with that, Jodi Arius had another possible explanation for how those photographs came to be in Travis's camera. When initially confronted by the existence of the images from the camera found in the washing machine, she tried several different possible denials, ranging from the images not being of her, to the police tampering with the timestamps on the images, and now something far more complicated and wholly implausible. She advanced the notion that someone had switched the memory card in the camera found in the washing machine with the camera she had previously used to take photos of herself and Travis. Though she'd been at an apparent dead end, she was unwilling to cede the point. She seemed prepared to keep evading, creating ever more elaborate fictional scenarios, anything to avoid the truth. She had clearly realized the photo's significance and was looking for a way to discount them, thereby removing what she saw as the only indisputable piece of evidence placing her at the crime scene. It appeared she thought she knew enough to explain away the DNA evidence collected at the scene, the blood, the hair, and perhaps even the palm print, but she was at a loss to find a rationalization for the time-stamped photographs. Detective Flores realized what she was trying to do and pointed out that her theory of switched memory cards was completely implausible. Your camera's here, his camera's there. He just bought that camera.
Well, the other camera that I used before that is broken. Now it's in my storage unit.
Are you saying those pictures are on that camera? Flores asked in an attempt to clarify what she was alleging.
What I'm saying is I had several memory cards for this camera that I don't have anymore, so I guess it's so far-fetched, she conceded, but I guess it's possible that my card could...
Flores interjected. So you're saying somebody took your pictures or card and is framing you and put that into his camera?
I'm just saying that if my memory cards were left at his house, he would have used those for his camera. I don't know. I can explain the blood, though, and I can explain the hair. I don't know about the palm print.
There it was. She really did believe that she could smile at the detective and have him believe that such a scenario was possible. Even in light of the scientific results, she held true to her story. Flores had spent 2 hours and 47 minutes with her and was no closer to a confession than when he started. The interview drew to a close with Arius asking to use the restroom. As soon as the detective left the room, she let out an audible sigh and threw her entire body back in the chair, her arms outstretched to the wall.
"You should have at least done your makeup, Jodi. Gosh!" she whispered aloud.
She next sang part of Dido's "Here With Me." She then spent a few seconds searching through the plastic garbage pail on the floor behind her. I was surprised when she suddenly stood up, placed her head on the floor, and did a handstand, her body perfectly aligned with the wall. Returning to the table, she sat quietly for a few moments before breaking into eerie laughter and then a few verses of "O Holy Night." Her search of the small table in the corner yielded a piece of paper and a pen that she used to scrawl as she waited for someone to come for her. After reviewing Jody Arias's interview of July 15th, I turned my attention to the videotaped statements of her parents, William, Bill, and Sandy Arias. Detective Flores interviewed the couple the same day, shortly after having spoken to Arias. I was curious to see if they had provided any information that would either support or undermine their daughter's unwavering claim that she had nothing to do with Travis's death. Detective Flores had already told me that they had no information, but I wanted to hear what they had to say. The couple were celebrating their 29th wedding anniversary in September 2008. Jody was the oldest of their four children. Bill also had a daughter from a previous marriage. Their interviews were conducted separately so that they would not have a chance to tailor their stories. Investigators typically don't meet with the parents of suspects because they seldom have much to offer related to the killing. However, in this case, Arias had returned home to Yreka, and both of her parents could speak to her daily activities and movements in the days before and after the killing. Interestingly, Jody's father, Bill Arias, had some concerning things to say about his daughter. He had just celebrated his 59th birthday, but appeared older, likely because of health issues involving his kidneys. Without prompting, he began to paint an unflattering picture of a young woman who didn't really get along with either of her parents. "She's a strange person," he said at one point, "because some, you know, after she left the house, you know, she just kind of got strange, you know? She's really friendly sometimes. She'll call and be real sweet, and 10 minutes later she'll call in a rage, you know, just screaming at my wife. And she did that for, the last year and a half she was doing that." What began to emerge was that the story of the relationship with Travis she had told to her family was in stark contrast to the way Travis's friends and people who knew the couple had described it. Arias had indicated to her parents that she and Travis had considered getting married. Bill described a phone call he received from his daughter shortly after she had moved to Mesa. "She called me hysterically crying," he recalled. "She snuck up at his house and she looked in the window and she saw him on the couch with another woman. And here she was planning on marrying this guy. So she just left. But then she stayed there, you know, for, I don't know, how many months, 6 months or something, and Jody would not let anybody say anything or discredit him either. 'Cause I did say a few things after she told me that he was with another girl. I said, 'You need to get the hell out of that town and leave that guy alone.' But then every time I called her, she was over his house. Every time I called her." In listening to the conversation, Flores and Bill Arias seemed like they were old friends sharing stories about a distant relative. Arias's father recounted a 3-hour conversation he and his wife had with Jody soon after Travis's death. Bill was on the dialysis machine when Jody had stopped by for a visit. He and Sandy were trying to find out why she believed she needed to leave town. And she goes, "'Cause I might be blamed for something." I go, "What?" And she goes, "I can't tell you." She goes, "I just won't tell you." And she refused, never told us. Bill went on to say that Jody quit her job at Casa Ramos after learning police had called the restaurant asking to speak with her. I said, "Well, what are you running away for if you're not guilty?" To which she replied, "'Cause I don't want to be a part of it." Flores took the opportunity to relate the challenges he had confronted when trying to speak to Jody.
"Well, I talked to her for over an hour and a half, and I left with some more questions than I had answers for. You know, I still don't know why. She just refused to tell me."
"She don't talk to us either," Bill commiserated with Flores, telling him that Jody treated her mother like crap. I mean, verbally abusive on the phone with her. "You know, we could never ask her anything about her personal life ever since the day she left the house." As it turned out, neither Bill nor Sandy had ever even seen a picture of Travis until after he'd died. Jody never showed them a thing. The information Bill shared next was of particular interest. He indicated that Arias had not been honest with her parents since she was 14.
You know, she doesn't trust us because we're parents. And when she was in eighth grade, she got busted for growing marijuana with our Tupperware, putting it on top of the roof. We found it and we called the sheriff's department and they busted her. And then, I don't know, we searched her room. And after that, she was kind of like, something turned in her head that we were nosy parents and we were going to search everything she had. So she hid everything from us. And she has never been honest with us since then. That her father was referencing an event from when Arius was 14 years old with such specificity indicated how significant the event had been to the family. This was important because it confirmed what Flores had just experienced during his interview with her. Arius had a practiced history of hiding and avoiding the truth in dealings with her parents, which she put to use in explaining away the importance of any item showing she had been the one who killed Travis. Bill also told Flores that Jody asked him to pick her up at her grandparents' house at 7:30 a.m. on the morning of July 15th and give her a ride to the rental car place. And I thought it was going to be for good, you know, and I'm thinking, And then when I was talking to her, she goes, "Oh, don't worry, Dad, I'm only going to be gone for 3 days. According to Arius's father, her plan was to visit with friends in the Monterey area of California. He told Flores that Jody had indicated she was planning to visit a couple of ex-boyfriends, Daryl Brewer and Matthew McCartney. But police were never able to establish her true destination based on what she had packed into the car. Jody's mother, Sandy, was also of the belief that her daughter was only intending to leave Yreka for a short jaunt, something her parents had come to expect from her. "That's Jody," she told Flores during a painful interview. Sandy Arius, a pleasant-looking brunette who had just turned 50 that past March, entered the interview room in tears. She was visibly distraught over her daughter's circumstances and broke out sobbing the moment she sat down at the table with Flores. The biggest hurdle for Sandy was her inability to reconcile Jody's seemingly ordinary behavior with the police's accusations that she had taken a life. She described her daughter's demeanor in the days after her trip to Utah in June as completely normal. Jody's normal behavior was in sharp contrast to what Sandy experienced at other times when she described her daughter as someone with mental problems who would freak out all the time. "I had quite a few of her friends call me and tell me that I needed to get her some help," she said, weeping. "She would call me in the morning all happy and call me an hour or two later in tears, crying and sobbing about something she didn't want to talk about. And it happened constantly." Like her husband, Sandy seemed to harbor her own initial suspicions about Jody's involvement in Travis's death, saying that was the first thing she asked her about when she came home. She went on to describe how, on the day Jody learned of Travis's death, she went not to her mother, but to her younger sister for comfort. "She was totally in tears. She cried for 2 or 3, 4 or 5 days, and, that's the first I asked her. I said, 'Did you go to Arizona?' And she said, 'No, I was nowhere near Arizona, and I have gas receipts and everything to prove it.' So, of course, I believed her, you know, but I questioned her about it." The significance of what Sandy was saying, that she, Jody Arius's own mother, had her suspicions about Jody's involvement in the murder, was not lost on Flores.
"But you had enough suspicion to ask her."
"Well, yeah."
Sandy Arius explained that her daughter guarded her privacy so vehemently that she wouldn't even let her and her husband stay with her when she lived in Palm Desert with a previous boyfriend, Daryl Brewer.
"She was afraid I would snoop through her stuff. That's the kind of relationship she had. I told her one day, 'You need some help, Jody.' I said, 'You've got this fantasy in your head that you had a rotten childhood and that we searched your room all the time and we did all this stuff and we didn't. And you need some help,' I said, 'because that didn't happen.'"
Sandy told Flores about a late-night visit she had with Jody the previous evening. She couldn't sleep and had called her daughter to ask if Jody could borrow her grandfather's car to drive over to the house so they could spend some time together.
Instead, Sandy ended up driving to her parents on Pine Street, where they sat outside in the car and talked.
In the last couple of weeks since Travis's death, we've had the best relationship we've had in our whole life. And I said, maybe this death has made her see that life is short. And, you know, you can't be this way, and it's changing her. So the last few weeks, I didn't spend a lot of time with her, but I talked to her more than I have ever talked to her since she left the house at 18.
At certain moments during the interview, Arias's mother appeared willing to entertain the idea that her daughter might have killed Travis.
I don't know. Maybe she did do it,
she conceded, wiping tears from her eyes before continuing.
I just cannot imagine her doing it.
I paused the video on those words and turned them over in my head. It is always difficult to watch parents of the accused struggle with their children's crimes. No matter how strained the relationship, few parents can really believe that their child is capable of taking a life. Sandy Arias was no different. But conflicted as Sandy may have been about Jody's possible involvement in Travis's death, as well as her apparent mental instability, one thing that Sandy was not conflicted about was Jody's intelligence.
Jody is a very intelligent person, she told Flores confidently.
Her mother's words echoed what I'd already come to observe, that I was dealing with a highly intelligent woman who happened to be a killer. It was apparent that Arias brought a level of careful forethought to each response, even though she had limited time to formulate her answers. She's extremely intelligent, and the more I've talked to her over the last month and a half, I know she's intelligent, Flores said. The detective's comment elicited a response from Arias's mother that shone a light on an aspect of Arias's personality that I would encounter again, an inflated sense of intelligence, a belief that she was smarter than everyone else.
She gave us a hard time because I never went to college, and she kept telling me, Mom, you need to read. You need to do this. You need to better your life.
Arias had made these criticisms, although she herself had not graduated from high school.
I don't know. I just can't even imagine. My God, I can't. I just can't even think about it,
Sandy said, trying to absorb the significance of the allegations against her daughter. Unfortunately, the evidence that we have is completely convincing to me. I mean, we have everything from fingerprints at the scene of the crime.
Well, I know her fingerprints are there.
Her DNA, things like her hair.
Well, you know she spent time with him, you know. So, does that prove that she killed him? She cleaned his house.
It was symbolic that Arias's mother was ending her interview in the same place as her daughter, by trying to excuse away the evidence from the scene.
Chapter 7. For the July 16th interview, it had been decided that Siskiyou County Sheriff's Detective Rachel Blaney would conduct it, while Detective Flores waited outside the room, monitoring what was being said. Looking back and now knowing Arias, it is obvious that she would never have bonded with a female detective, because she seemed to know that she would have a more difficult time manipulating a woman. During her nearly two-hour interrogation with Detective Blaney, Arias twice asked to see the crime scene photos that Flores had declined to show her the previous day, and once again her requests were denied. For her part, Blaney made little headway, and it got to the point in the interview where Blaney asked if Arias would prefer to continue with Detective Flores. If you want to speak to Detective Flores as opposed to me, you can do that. I thought it would be easier for you to talk to a woman who could relate to some of these feelings, Blaney told her.
I kind of do want to talk to him, because he's always been in contact with Travis's family a lot, Arias replied, without actually knowing what Flores's contact with the family had been.
When Flores arrived a few minutes later, dressed in a brown button-down shirt and a pair of slacks, Arias greeted him with a hey and a smile.
Rachel said something about you wanting to see some photos, but I don't think I can show you any more photos, Flores told her, obviously uncomfortable with the idea of tipping his hand any further,
by allowing her to see the remaining photographs. He had called me after the first interview and expressed concern that Arias only wanted to see the pictures to learn what police had observed at the scene. Her next statement confirmed his suspicions.
The reason I asked was because I just feel like it might help me piece some things together. And this is more of a selfish reason. I think it might give me some sense of closure. I know it's kind of morbid. I don't even think I really deserve closure. His family does. But I wasn't able to attend his funeral, and it's just, I don't know, that's just why, mostly.
What is it you want to know about the photos? Flores asked her. Do you want to see the room? Do you want to see the bathroom? Or do you want to see him? Or is it the photos before it happened that you want to see? She told him she wanted to see the pictures of everything, but the ones she was really interested in were the ones in the bathroom, the ones of Travis's body in the shower.
I don't want to show you those. Not in good conscience.
Okay. Is there any that you can?
By this point, it was clear that Arias's interest in the photographs was beyond an obsession. When she realized that Flores was not going to let her view the crime scene photos, she turned the conversation back to Travis's family. She wanted to know which relatives he had spoken to, showing particular interest in Travis's grandmother, Norma Sarvey. She'd already told Flores about Travis's close relationship with his grandmother, who had raised him since he was a boy. It was as if she wanted Flores to see how close her relationship with Travis had been, otherwise she wouldn't know so much about his family and those closest to him. She even went so far as to ask if Flores would be willing to deliver a message from her to them.
I'll let you decide what to say and I'll relay it exactly how you want me to, he assured her.
His willingness to oblige her desire to reach out to the family seemed a calculated effort to gain her trust. As frustrating as it must have been to indulge Arias's many deflections, I admired Detective Flores's single-mindedness as he pressed on.
So were you there that day? Please tell me. Did you just miss him? Did he call you? Did he miss you?
The only explanation I can think of is that you went there for one purpose, and that's to hurt him.
Were you guys alone?
Answer that for me. Should I be looking for somebody else? Was there anybody else with you besides you and Travis? Are you protecting somebody else?
Flores's questions were met with a lengthy silence.
Jody?
I'm sorry, I just don't know what to do. I'm just trying to figure things out.
It was obvious by her statement that she was trying to work out a new story and buying time so she could concoct it. Arias maintained that it was all blur before again requesting to see the photos to help her bring it into focus. Flores didn't close off the possibility, telling her detectives had taken them to Reading when they went to pick up the rental car, and that perhaps she could view them once the investigators returned to Wairika.
Oh, because there's something in the rental car, Arias suggested.
Like what?
Maybe blood, she said matter-of-factly.
In the trunk? In the back seat?
That's what we are going to look for, so...
I was thinking maybe the handle, the steering wheel, and things that get touched.
It appeared Arias was almost confessing when she alluded to the possibility that there might be blood in the rental car. But investigators were never able to recover any biological material to be used for the DNA test because the car had been cleaned by an employee after she returned it. She had also removed the floor mats before returning the car. Even though Arias continued to deny being in Mesa on the day of the murder, Flores began to premise his questions as if she had been. He asked her whether she'd been worried that Travis's roommates would find her there, how long she was in the house after it happened, why she threw the camera in the washing machine.
"Do you remember those things?" he asked.
No, Arias replied. They started to talk about the white Ford Focus that Arias had rented for the drive. The investigation into the car had determined that Arias had actually rejected the first car the rental company had given her, another Ford Focus, but a red one, and he wanted to find out more about it.
I know they were going to rent you another car, but then something happened with the first car.
Either you didn't like it, or I don't know if it had problems.
This was a detail that I considered important because it spoke to her planning. She claimed she hadn't wanted a red car because it would be more noticeable, akin to a red flag, that police were more likely to stop someone in a red car. But I suspected she chose a more neutral color to blend in. After discussing the fact that Travis had apparently canceled plans to see her at the end of May, Flores returned to his questions.
Did Travis know you were coming?
Flores watched for a reaction.
He knew? He coaxed.
I saw you kind of shake your head a little bit.
This is hard,
Arias said, her voice cracking. For the first time, she looked away from the detective, her gaze fixed to a point on the wall. It appeared she was trying to buy time to come up with her next line.
That's okay, he said, as he tried to coax her along, peppering her with questions. Did he know you were coming? Did you guys talk on the phone?
What was the discussion about?
Did you guys talk when you were en route to Phoenix?
Arias's reply was barely audible.
Yeah,
she mumbled, looking down at her feet.
And with that, she placed herself at the crime scene, finally succumbing to the evidence left behind in Travis's camera.
Just briefly. I told him my phone was dying, which was true. I thought I left my charger in Monterey. I really honestly thought I left my charger there, and I had been talking all day, just on the phone. I take a lot of pictures of myself.
She smiled.
I noticed, Flores replied with a laugh, referring to several selfies police had found on her cell phone that had been taken during her recent trip.
I am kind of picky about it. I take like 20 and I am like, delete, 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 and I keep 2 or 3.
So he knew you were coming. He was expecting you?
Arias did not respond, instead remaining quiet with her hands folded in her lap.
Obviously you guys had a little encounter. Is that when those pictures were taken?
Flores asked, referring to the 6 photographs of their sexual rendezvous.
Did he even show you those pictures?
This was the longest silence I had seen from Arias since the start of her 2-day-long interview. Unlike other times when she would close herself off in the fetal position or hide her face in her hands, this time she looked off toward the corner, apparently thinking about how much she was going to reveal and the style with which she was going to deliver the line. She'd already put herself at the house and was on the brink of having to explain what happened inside.
It's going to be all right, Jody.
I feel really powerless in here,
she whimpered, appearing to finally realize that she was caught and for the first time couldn't figure out how to explain that she'd been merely present at the crime scene but had not committed the crime. Her repeated requests to see the photographs had been denied, so she had been unable to craft a story based on the evidence police had gathered. Her only way out was to change the subject. The detective let enough time pass to demonstrate his concern before moving ahead with his inquiry. After talking to her about whether Travis's roommates were home when she arrived, Arias explained that she got in at 3 in the morning.
Did you guys spend all day together then? Did you go anywhere? Did you stay in the house?
Slept, Arias said.
Well, after a long trip, I would sleep too.
Arias recalled that when she got there, Travis was watching some stupid music video with people dancing with foil boxes on their heads. Suddenly she grew animated, mimicking the character's hand movements. She was speaking to Flores as if they were friends, sharing stories about a mutual acquaintance.
It was weird. It was robotic kind of music. It's just like stupid, pointless stuff. Being as driven and deep as he is, it is just funny that he watches stuff like that.
The detective laughed along, obviously hoping that this somewhat bonding experience would give her the impetus to share what really happened. He redirected her to the afternoon photographic session.
Is that when those were taken that day?
In a barely audible whisper, Arias shared with Flores something that he didn't know.
We also made a video. And we deleted it.
On that camera?
On his camera,
Arias confirmed. Her admission came as a surprise to me. She hadn't said much of anything up to that point, and now she was volunteering information that was not even known to the detective. I wondered what her motivation for this new disclosure was, and the only thing that seemed logical was that in her mind she and Flores were sharing a moment. It was clear to me now that her preoccupation with the photos was partially an effort to try to find out if their sex video had been recovered. If Flores was surprised by this revelation, he didn't show it. "Videos are hard to get when they are erased," he told her. "They take up so much room, whereas pictures are a little different." The video would not have offered any clues that the pictures hadn't already given him, so it was not surprising that he moved on to the bigger question of motive. What happened after that? What went wrong? I know that the last photos of him were taken at 5:20, 5:30, and you said he doesn't like you to take pictures of him. He was very private about the shower, Arias disclosed, and added that so was she. Laughing, Flores asked, "Is that why you were taking pictures of him in the shower, trying to get back at him?" Arias denied that was the reason. "I am surprised he allowed you to take pictures of him in the shower. The first few looked like he wasn't that comfortable, but obviously whatever you were saying to him appeared to make him a little more comfortable."
"What went wrong? Did he say something to you?"
Arias took several deep breaths and turned her face away as the detective pressed her for an answer.
"Were you angry about something? Were you frustrated? What was it?"
Her face was almost completely hidden behind strands of her long brown hair, but I could tell she was listening closely. It appeared she was weighing her options and had come to a place where she was finally ready to free herself of the tremendous burden she had been carrying around for the past month.
It looked as though she was about to say something when suddenly the sound of Flores's pager going off interrupted the pin-dropping silence.
16 seconds ticked by as Flores checked his phone and looked at the message. It appeared the short reprieve allowed her to collect herself enough to sit up in her chair, push her hair back away from her face, and take a breath as she waited for the detective's attention to return to her.
"What are you going to do with the rental car?"
she asked, immediately redirecting the focus of the questioning away from the precipitating incident to something completely unrelated.
"Are they going to bring it here?"
"There were several photos of him," Flores continued, trying to return the conversation to the moments before the killing. But Arias was now focused on the present and the search of the rental car currently underway. I could feel Flores's frustration as he inhaled deeply and let out a sigh. Still, he did his best to bring Arias back to the scene in the bathroom.
"There were several photos of him, and the last one is of him sitting in the shower. That's when I think it happened."
"What did you do? What happened, Jody? We've come this far. Did you plan on doing that the whole time?"
"No," she answered, clearly disengaged as she began running her fingers through her hair and staring blankly as the staccato of Flores's questioning increased.
"Then why? Tell me."
"I don't believe you planned it," he told her.
I was familiar with the interrogation technique Flores was now employing, where the officers are taught to minimize the suspect's involvement in hopes that they will admit something.
"But then I don't understand why. Why you took a gun with you?"
"I didn't," Arias insisted.
"Then where did you get it? Did you bring it with you? Did you get it there in Arizona?"
"I didn't have it in my possession."
"Then who had it? If you didn't have it and Travis didn't have it, then who had it?"
"Jody," Flores implored, "please."
"I can't,"
she said in her best B-actress angst.
"Why not? Are you protecting somebody else? Why would somebody else do this?"
"I don't know."
"Did someone catch you there? Someone not expecting you to be there?"
Arias's reply was inaudible.
"Then who was it?"
"I don't know,"
she said, looking up at the ceiling and nervously pulling on her hand, likely trying to figure out which direction her story should pivot to next.
"Okay, what do you remember from the time you were taking pictures and the time you left?
What happened? What happened after that last picture was taken? After they went back and forth, Flores finally began to push her. If somebody else was there with you, we need to know that. Why would somebody do that just because you're there with Travis?
They didn't say, she replied.
For the first time, there was an answer. Not much, but something he could build off. He murmured.
They didn't say,
Arius repeated in a faint voice. He didn't say?
They.
And with that, Arius had the beginnings of her second story, one in which she had been present for Travis's death, but it wasn't her committing the crime. It was they. What was the first thing they did to him? You were there, you saw it. Flores hoped that what Arius was about to tell him might actually be what happened, because it could be that two people had done this. If she were to give him names, it wouldn't be so implausible.
I actually didn't see it. I heard it first,
Arius began. Was there an argument?
Not between Travis and them.
Any argument between anybody?
Yeah.
She paused, patting tears from her eyes.
Is there any way I can see those pictures?
It was a telling moment of lucidity during a moment that at least superficially appeared emotional, and it was a strategy of hers that I would encounter later on. Even in the midst of crafting this new story, she had not lost sight of her true aim, the crime scene photos and how they could enable her to fabricate a story that matched the events depicted in the photographs. No, he told her, not right now.
Can I see them soon? She begged.
By this point, her request had morphed into a desperate plea. You need to start letting me know what happened, Flores instructed her. You are saying that other people were there. You know how much that concerns me?
I don't know. They know where I live, or they know where my parents are. I don't know if they know where my grandparents are. They know my address. They know where my family is,
Arius contended, sobbing and wiping at her tears.
Sorry.
So you are trying to say you're doing this to protect your family? Why would somebody do this to you and to him? Flores asked incredulously.
I don't think they really intended to do anything to me.
So you are saying somebody followed you all the way to Arizona from here?
I think I was an element of surprise for them.
You were an element of surprise, Flores parroted, an air of frustrated disbelief in his tone.
I am guessing.
They didn't expect you to be there.
I mean, they had to have seen my car.
Is this someone who lives in Mesa locally?
I didn't recognize them.
Well, you have to give me a motive, Flores told her. Why would they do this? Were they going after Travis?
Arius collapsed onto the table, resting her head in the crook of her elbow.
You tell me this, but you give me no reason.
They didn't discuss much,
Arius said,